Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to steal a Rembrandt? While Hollywood has fueled visions of suave connoisseurs snatching masterworks to finance their lives in Monte Carlo, the reality is often far less glamorous. As targets for theft, Rembrandts rank second only to Picassos, and art thieves make off with an estimated $6 billion worth of treasures every year. But they often know little about the priceless objects they abscond with, including the fact that it is nearly impossible to fence a world-famous piece of art without getting caught. Investigative reporter Tom Mashberg is the former Sunday editor for the Boston Herald, and he's written for the Boston Globe, New York Times, and Vanity Fair. His new book, co-authored with Anthony M. Amore, is called Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Lest anyone be concerned that all these descriptions of the thefts in this book are like a DIY guide for would-be thieves, I have to say this book reads more like a cautionary tale.
Right, right. Well, we're hoping some thieves will pick it up and decide against making the mistake of stealing a Rembrandt.
And Rembrandt is stolen so often in part because everybody's heard of him?
Well, right, exactly. One of the things we note in the book is that the most likely Rembrandt thief is not any kind of art connoisseur. It's really just kind of a run-of-the-mill criminal who's trying to step up in class from, say, you know, robbing a convenience store to something more profitable. And the name Rembrandt is so iconic that they've heard of it, so they go, well, that must be worth something. And that's essentially why they often target Rembrandt as opposed to maybe a great artist like Titian or, you know, someone like that whose name they wouldn't recognize.
And he was also hugely prolific in his time, so works by Rembrandt are fairly readily available at major museums, is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was remarkably prolific. He left behind at least 300 oil paintings, 700 drawings, and 80 metal plates. And from those metal plates, he created many prints with his own hand. So you have about 1,000 authenticated Rembrandt work scattered around the globe, more than 50 of them here in the United States, just the paintings and drawings and many of the etchings. So it's basically he's a ripe target, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And they're also not necessarily, these are not wall-sized paintings. A lot of them are easy to sort of slip into a backpack.
Right. He did actually like to do a lot of small portraits, and as you say, so those are, you know, I mean, you can grab it and just put it right under your arm and run out the door before anyone spots you.
So, Tom, tell us about the takeaway Rembrandt, stolen four separate times from the same museum.
Right. Well, that's a kind of a somewhat, well, it's an entertaining story. I guess it's rather farcical, although it's kind of sad at the same time. Now, the painting is back where it belongs, which is the Dulwich Gallery, which is in London. But it does hold the Guinness Book of World Records distinction as the most stolen work of art. And that's because it's been robbed, as you said, four times by four separate criminals over a period of about 25 years.
And, of course, it is a Rembrandt, but as Rembrandts go, it's not especially remarkable. It's a portrait of an engraver from Rembrandt's own time. Is that right?
Right. Well, it has actually a very interesting backstory because the fellow that he paints, Jacob de Guyn, was a close friend of his. And, he did that painting to sort of honor him, and it was to immortalize him after his death. And so, of course, this painting made its way safely through the ages for 300 years and landed in this gallery in London. And all of a sudden, the poor, thing was routinely stolen. So it speaks to a major concern that a lot of us have, is that, we have these wonderful works that made their way through time, and they were safe all these years, and then suddenly they wind up in museums where they just don't have enough security to protect them.
And at least for a time, was it between the third and fourth thefts or after the last one, the Dulwich Gallery thought, maybe we should just hide this thing away?
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, Dulwich people had this kind of British stiff upper lip attitude about the robberies. They were like, well, we got it back, and, we'll just be more careful next time. But after the third one, they did say, well, let's maybe hide it away. And then, you know, then that left a gap on the wall. They put it back. It was stolen again. So my understanding is they've improved the security pretty much since then. It hasn't been stolen in about 20 years. So.
Well, it is one of those stories like, you know, steal my Rembrandt once, shame on me.
steal my Rembrandt
four times, I better fix the security system.
No, you're absolutely right. And what you find is security is very uneven at museums and galleries and private collections around Europe and the United States. So, you know, while some Rembrandts would just be almost impossible to get near, others are really just kind of something you can pluck from a wall.
And in fact, I was really surprised by this. A very large number of museum thefts are carried out with the help of someone who either currently works there or has worked there in the past.
Right. Well, it's probably not much of a surprise that there's often an insider because, you know, they know the lay of the land and they might know when there's an alarm system check going on or could do something as simple as leave the latch open on a bathroom window. You know, several museums have been broken in through the bathroom window and like the old Beatles song. And so you have to... You always have to assume everyone is a suspect. Nobody until you can completely rule them out.
Yeah, you know, reading that, it made me think that maybe the best investment museums can make in security is hiring HR people who are going to really check out who's going to come work there.
Well, you make a wonderful point. I mean, here's a perfect case in point. It involves the Isabella Gardner Museum here in Boston.
Yeah.
Now, this poor museum was robbed in 1990, and you know, extremely valuable works of art were taken, three Rembrandts and a Vermeer among them. And it's considered the largest heist monetarily in U.S. history because the art is valued at $500 million. And here it was, here it is, 1990. This wasn't the, you know, old times or anything. And the two people they had guarding the museum during the overnight shift were, you know, a couple of very unpracticed and inexperienced local college students who happen to have an interest in art.
Hmm.
And obviously they didn't have a clue how to properly secure the place when they were tricked into opening the door. What happened was these men dressed as police officers tricked them into opening the front door, and once the guys had gotten access, they quickly subdued them with handcuffs and duct tape, and they had the run of the museum at that point for almost 2 hours.
And that's such a poignant story because, as I understand it, Isabella Stewart Gardner wanted everything left exactly the way it was at the time of her death. So there are still blank spots on the wall.
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right. It's very bittersweet. There's, you know, Mrs. Gardner was famous for collecting really interesting works of art early on and bringing them back to Boston. And she created this kind of Italian-style palace in which she displayed all of her works, more than 3,000, a wide variety of items. But her will stipulates that nothing is to be shifted from the position it's been in. You can't you can't replace the blank space on the wall where the Rembrandt used to be with another great work that might be in storage or something. So it is people always stop at that empty frame and kind of pause, and there's a bit of a hush. And, you know, there's a sort of a, you're right, it's a somber moment.
So your co-author for this book is actually the person retained by the museum to try and get these things back. Is that right?
Yes. Anthony Amore is an excellent investigator. Now, he came along in 2005. He wasn't around when the museum was robbed. And he came in and he professionalized the security very well. He had worked with the TSA after 9/11. And once he got that up to snuff, he became very intrigued with the heist. And he basically became sort of obsessed with solving it. And so he's been on the hunt for 6 years now and just works tirelessly day in and day out trying to find them.
I really have to admire that because it seems like a thankless task, something that's been gone for now 21 years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, every so often Anthony disappears for a while, and then I get an email from him that says, another 6 months of my life wasted.
So tell us about this. Was it 1997 that you were taken in a car to a warehouse and shown something that might have been one of the three stolen Rembrandts from that collection?
Yes. The robbery occurred in 1990, and the case had just absolutely gone dead. And by 1997, there was so little progress in it that the museum announced that it had increased the reward to $1 million. The reward, by the way, is $5 million today. I saw that, and I thought, well, how on earth could this not be solved? It's been 7 years. And so I just began digging into it because I had met some criminals who had been involved in art thievery in the Boston area, and I started looking into their backgrounds and reviewing their histories, and I started finding some new leads, and one of those leads brought me directly to a known Rembrandt thief, a man who had stolen two Rembrandts in Massachusetts prior to the Gardner heist. His name is Miles Connor. Of course, he was in prison at the time of the heist, which is, you know, a pretty solid alibi, but he had people on the outside, and he finally told me that it was his view. He had put together a plot for robbing the Gardner, a very exacting plot, and he believed very strongly that it was carried out by his, what he calls, pals or chums on the outside, and that they were going to try to use the paintings to leverage him out of a long prison sentence as a sort of get-out-of-jail-free card.
And in fact, that was why he stole his most recent Rembrandt. Was he was already indicted on other theft charges and takes this painting hoping that he'll be able to help the police solve the crime and get a lesser sentence.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's one of the rare instances where somebody actually profited from stealing a Rembrandt. What happened was he was going to do 20 years, 10 state and 10 federal, and he was hoping he could get it reduced to to do all the years concurrently, so it would just be 10. And he kept asking around, what do I have to do to get out of this jackpot? You know, and at one point he sort of just jokingly said, what, do I have to steal a Rembrandt? And someone he knew in law enforcement said, well, you know, that might work. Well, it put the bug right in his ear, and he set up this elaborate robbery of the Museum of Fine Arts, a major and beautiful museum in Boston, and you know, he had guys on the outside with machine guns, and he had several people on the inside whose job was to subdue the docents. And he ran out the door with the Rembrandt right under his arm and hid it under a friend's bed. And about 3 weeks later, he traded it back, and lo and behold, he got his sentence reduced.
Well, you know, it's funny. Connor is obviously morally bankrupt, but there's something about him that you have to admire for that amount of moxie.
You're right. I mean, that's the thing about Miles is he's got a lot of charm. He's rather educated. He speaks much more. He's very informed about art and antiquities and actually sort of appreciates artwork. But at the same time, as you said, he steals. He spent many years just stealing, you know, without any remorse. And that's how he made a good living.
My guest is Tom Mashberg. He's an investigative reporter and former Sunday editor for the Boston Herald. His new book, co-authored with Anthony M. Amore, is called Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. We'd love for you to join the conversation. You can get in to 1-800-933-5372 by calling now. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is investigative reporter Tom Mashberg. He is former Sunday editor for the Boston Herald and author of the new book Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. Co-author of that book is Anthony M. Amore. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you via email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. So, Tom, I want to go back and just get a few more details about the circumstances under which you were taken to see this canvas that may or may not have been Rembrandt's Storm on the Sea of Galilee.
Well, sure. It was a very kind of exciting event. What happened was I had been trying to track down the location of the paintings through a couple of associates of Miles Connor who were on the outside and were known to have been kind of the guardians of his property. Mm-hmm. His vast collection of stolen property, he had put it all into a giant, back of a giant van and stored it on the property of one of his criminal associates. So I started hunting after this criminal associate and putting some pressure on him, and the fellow finally went and talked to Connor, and they emerged, and they said, yes, we can make a deal to return the art in exchange for getting Miles Connor out of prison. Well, the authorities just basically laughed it off and said, no, we don't believe them. And so they became somewhat frustrated, and they said, what do we have to do to make them believe us? I said, well, why don't you show me? I'm a reporter. I can guard your information as a source. And then I'll report on it, and we'll see if that moves the ball a little bit. And so it was for that reason that I got picked up one night outside the newspaper office. It was close to midnight, and I was driven around for a little while, so I was very disoriented. You know, I couldn't exactly know what neighborhood I was in, and I was taken to this warehouse, a very, you know, inconspicuous warehouse. And they brought me upstairs to a storage room, and the fellow opened the door, and he pulled out this giant tube, and he opened it up and unfurled before me what appeared to be the Storm on the Sea of Galilee, one of the most famous paintings stolen from the gardener.
Hmm. So, I mean, you have learned a great deal about art, but you are not an expert necessarily in verification. I mean, what is your sense? Did it look real to you? Would it have been possible to tell, given the exposure that you had to it?
No, not at all. I mean, you're quite right. All I could do was sort of take a kind of a mental snapshot of it, and then I went and described it in detail to the museum's curators, and they issued a release afterwards saying that based on how I described it and where I said it had been, looked like it had been cut and frayed, because it was cut from its frame, you see, when it was stolen, mm-hmm. They said it was possible that it could be the real thing. And but of course, again, possible is not good enough. You need the real thing. And after that, I actually had something else come along, which was, I thought, even more convincing. I received some paint chips, which were identified as paint chips from Rembrandt's era.
Huh.
And I gave those to the museum, and law enforcement checked them out, and they agreed that they were genuine. So, but after that, everything kind of just ground to a halt until Anthony came along. He really picked up the investigation off its back and started making it happen.
Were you concerned at all about your personal safety?
Not really, no. It really struck me almost as a little bit like silly, frankly, kind of like this sort of secret squirrel adventure. You know, I didn't really take it. So thank you for asking, but no, I wasn't.
My guest is Tom Mashberg. He's co-author of the new book, Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. We'll start on the phones now. The telephone number, 1-800-933-5372. We have Mark on the line in Arlington. Hello, Mark.
Hi, I'm always curious as to what the incentive is for stealing a famous work of art, because I don't see many ways in which you could convert it into cash without getting caught. I mean, there isn't an auction house that's not going to know it's been stolen. There isn't a collector that's going to at least suspect as much or be able to authenticate the work.
Well, Mark, you're absolutely right. It's really a fool's errand, and we point that out again and again in the book. What the problem is that these criminals are extremely short-sighted. I mean, they're good at breaking into a place or subduing your guard with a gun, but they're terrible at figuring out what to do with what they've stolen either beforehand or afterward. And so they immediately discover that there's no secondary market for it, that there's really no black market for it, and they become very frustrated, and then they try to sell it back to the museum for a reward or insurance, and usually they get stung and arrested as a result of that. And so a lot of them just give up entirely, and they'll put the Rembrandt or other famous work of art in a public location, like a train station or in a, you know, in a pile of bushes in a public park, and literally just call the police and say, go pick it up, because they're tired of handling it.
Yeah, it's funny that some of these seem to take on a sort of Edgar Allan Poe quality, where they just haunt the person who has taken them and bring no remuneration and not even any pleasure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's there was one fellow in Cincinnati, and he stole a couple of Rembrandts, and he was quickly stung and arrested, and he did some years in jail, and he was kind of a little bit of a cocky guy who enjoyed being nicknamed Rembrandt while he was in prison. But it did come back to haunt him a few years later. He got out, and he was stealing some shampoo from a convenience store, and ended up having a fight with a cop and got arrested and sent back to jail in a more ignominious manner.
So he's just a two-bit crook who took something really valuable one time, essentially.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. And nowadays, he's just a really nice guy who sells real estate. He's very pleasant, and he kind of rues the bruising of his reputation. You know, he regrets having done that because it does stay with you. I mean, if you're someone who's cut a Rembrandt from a frame or stolen one or in any way marred something that valuable, you know, your name kind of goes down in history in a pretty unpleasant way.
Googleable in the worst possible sense.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the police units that are dispatched to handle these things. Is it always a local crime initially? When do the feds get involved? Talk about that.
Right. Well, so for the longest time, it was treated as a local crime. And although you might bring in the feds for advice, the local cops would take it over. But after the Gardner heist, Senator Kennedy approached Congress, and they basically upped the penalties for art theft into sort of federal statute, you know, the federal crimes. And then they also created an investigative team at the FBI for hunting down stolen art. So now if this were to happen, you'd immediately have not just local police, but you'd have an FBI presence, and you'd have an international hunt through Interpol and Scotland Yard and so forth, because they're all very well coordinated now.
What do we know about the international market for these things? Would it be easier to fence this to someone overseas in a place that where at least one's friends and neighbors might not realize that the work was stolen?
Well, if it's a work that's not, you know, enormously famous but valuable, it's possible to sell it, create some false provenance and sell it, say, you know, in Eastern Europe or something, and maybe not get draw attention to it. But when you're talking about a major work of art, particularly a Rembrandt, there's really no evidence of any character like you see in the James Bond movie, Dr. No, who is this sort of malevolent billionaire who, you know, collects art for his own selfish enjoyment and hides it in his little private lair. That's a big myth, and one of the things we do in the book is basically puncture that myth, because unfortunately it has the result of distracting a lot of people. The real crooks are the local petty criminals, and you need to get after them. It's not a good idea to immediately leap to this conclusion that the Sultan of Brunei is the art, and you better go interrogate him.
Anyone who has ever witnessed or even thought about the way these priceless works are installed when they're put on exhibition knows how carefully they have to be handled. It seems to me, Tom, another crime against humanity in some ways is the damage that can happen to these works. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, it is heartbreaking to think that they could be damaged beyond repair. Now, in the case of the Rembrandts we write about, a few were damaged, but it was reparable damage, and one had some bird droppings on it because it had been hidden in on a farm. Some had, you know, there were some had some scratches on it. There's actually some very interesting footage of one of the stolen Rembrandts from Cincinnati in the 70s, and these two guys are kind of handling it like a couple of college students would handle, like an old bookcase. They're sort of bumping it around, trying to shove it in the back of a car. The guy's got a cigarette hanging from his lips. You know, he wasn't exactly giving it the greatest care. But there is one terrible episode that we disclose in the book for the first time, and this was a case where in the 30s, where a Rembrandt stolen from an Earl's castle in England was actually burned by the thieves after they couldn't figure out what to do with it.
Hmm. And there have been other cases where was there a guy who's was about to get caught and his mom was tearing up the paintings things that he'd stolen?
Breitwiser. Well, Stephen Breitwiser is one of the odder characters in art theft history because he stole many hundreds of works of all kinds, not just paintings and drawings and sketches, but he liked to steal sort of interesting ancient artifacts, historical items from, say, Rome and Greece. And he just piled them in his room with the shades drawn. I mean, he just piled them in there like a, you know, like a pack rat. And finally, when the police started, closing in on him, his mother was so afraid of all this evidence around the house that she started throwing bunches and bunches of things in a local river and even cut some canvases up and put them down a garbage disposal in her sink. So that's one terrible episode where, you know, one guy just wrought havoc. He only did about 2 or 3 years, and then he wrote a book. I guess he's still out there, but that's just not a very common scenario.
So it's not quite the same as theft from an institution, but it sounds like there's also a lot of fakes out there that people are persuaded to pay a great deal of money for that are not, in fact, original Rembrandts.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays it's very difficult to pass off a fake because the technology is incredibly sophisticated, and you can really determine so much about the work by using special lighting and X-ray and even MRI. So, there are certainly people who would be gullible enough to buy fakes, thinking they were real Rembrandts. I mean, around here, one of the Gardner items that was stolen, it's a self-portrait. There's a story of one guy who he was convinced by some con man that the con man had it, and the con man had basically just Xeroxed it and sort of poured some tea on it to make it look old. And he managed to get like $50,000 out of this guy for, you know, by claiming it was the Gardner's Rembrandt. So, you know, there are fools out there who will do that.
So what can you tell us about the progress that Anthony Amore has made in getting closer to recovering these paintings?
Well, Anthony is very, very optimistic and encouraged in recent months. He believes that that things will be happening relatively soon. He says in our lifetime, which is because he tries to be vague about everything, but he feels like he's on the right track. And when he speaks, he says, you know, they will come back. You will see them again. He's very adamant about that. So I have nothing but confidence in Anthony. I mean, he's a great investigator, a good guy, and, he's just devoted to this in an obsessive way. It's taken over his life.
So for things that remain missing, I guess either authorities are going to get them back very quickly after they were stolen, or it could be decades before something turns up.
Yeah, it's true. Usually it's within a few weeks or months. If not, you might have to wait 5 to 7 years. That was the case with the theft of a Rembrandt self-portrait in Stockholm. Quite a beautiful self-portrait, one of the few that he did that has copper and gold in it. And it was stolen by these armed characters who burst into the National Museum and subdued everyone with automatic weapons, grabbed some paintings, threw them in bags, ran out, and then they hopped into a little speedboat, and off they went. Well, once again, they had no plan for selling or disposing of the art on the back end, and so a bunch of them were captured and some of the art was returned, but the Rembrandt remained missing for 5 years and finally turned up actually in Los Angeles, just kind of all wrapped up in you know, packing material in the basement of some pawn shop where it had just sat there. You know, so they just didn't know what to do with it. Nobody could figure out what to do with it. But that's not atypical, like a period of time like that before you can track it down.
You know, it is sort of scary to think that some things that remain missing might have been sold in a pawn shop for, you know, $200 to someone who thinks, oh, I have a nice copy of a pretty painting.
Absolutely. I mean, that, one of the, you're so right. It is, for all we know, somebody does have what they think is a copy of, say, Vermeer's The Concert, which was stolen from the Gardner Museum. And they think, oh, well, I just bought that at a flea market with some local artist who threw it together. And it could conceivably be the real thing. And that's why it's a constant effort to publicize those stolen artworks, to remind people what they look like, to have people, you know, if they see anything that really resembles it, to call the museum, to call law enforcement to report it, because, you know, you could just stumble across it in that manner.
Tom Mashberg is with us. He's an investigative reporter, former Sunday editor for the Boston Herald. His new book, written with Anthony M. Amore, is called Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is investigative reporter Tom Mashberg. He's former Sunday editor for the Boston Herald and co-author of the new book Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. You can join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. Tom, I certainly don't want to give people any ideas here, but it does seem that if thieves halfway know what they're doing, they would take a Rembrandt etching rather than an oil painting.
Right. The thing about etchings is, you're right, they're a little bit easier to grab. They tend to be in, you know, galleries and private collections. And they're a little bit harder. It's much harder to demonstrate that an etching, you know, was stolen. But what you find a lot is that you have these characters who do this thing you see right out of the movies where they slip into a special library where there are some authentic Rembrandt etchings, and they bring in, you know, hidden on their person sort of a decent copy of one they want to steal. And then when no one's looking, they take a razor out and they slit the real one out of the book it's in and slip the bad one in.
Wow.
and off they go. And sometimes those thefts are not recognized for years, even decades, because nobody else has come along to look at it. So in cases like that, you could probably, you know, move it for high value and sort of hide your trail.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Matthew on the line in Chicago. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Great, thanks.
Great. My question for you was something kind of along the same lines as art theft, but kind of the inverse. Have you heard of people like the artist known as Banksy, who took one of his pieces and actually installed it in the Louvre?
No, I don't know about it. It sounds like you'd get in trouble for doing that.
Well, he undoubtedly did, but kind of, I guess, this artist's M.O. is that he mostly does street art and stencil art, and he does installment pieces. He also got in trouble for putting a fake blow-up doll of Guantanamo detainee in Disneyland. He does things, you know, for value and shock and, you know, to get emotional response out of people. And he actually installed one of his pieces in the Louvre, and it was there for over 24 hours. I wanted you to comment on that or see if you had ever heard of that. Thanks.
Certainly an interesting strategy. I guess he's pretty far out there in terms of making people notice his work, which is definitely something that modern art has focused on.
Well, the interesting thing about the Louvre, of course, is that the Mona Lisa is there, and it is, you know, it is one of those paintings that unfortunately you can no longer really look at with any great pleasure because it's hidden behind all of this thick plexiglass, and there's armed guards around it all the time, and you have to stand in line. You don't get a really good view of it, and that's the tragedy of something like that because, you know, the museums are always sort of battling this fine line between accessibility and vulnerability. I mean, when you go into a museum, you don't want to go into an armed camp. You want to be able to commune peacefully with the art, put your nose maybe an inch away from it, look at the brush strokes and whatnot. And so that's why they really can't have things like whistling alarms and, you know, clanging bells and window grates that, you know, snap shut anytime you get within a foot of a painting because it just would destroy the whole atmosphere.
We have an email here from Bill in North Richland Hills who says, any thoughts on the theft of the Mona Lisa in 1911, particularly the idea that forgeries were done before the painting was retrieved and that a painting would be stolen with the theft used as part of the provenance for establishing the forgery for a buyer?
No, I don't know. I don't know much about the history of that case, but there are some very good books about it, very easy to find on Amazon.
When you go and look at an original, I mean, is there something about Rembrandt that you think even these dumb crooks who are just stealing it for money, do you think they ever even look at the works? I mean, do you have a sense of that?
I suspect not. I mean, I've never really spoken with any criminal who's really shown a kind of intense respect for what, you know, Rembrandt was able to do with light and shadow and delicacy of brush strokes and the amazing ability to capture, you know, a micro expression on a face, you know, all of these things which are make him, even though, you know, it's sort of a cliche, old Rembrandt, I mean, he really was and is probably the greatest artist in history because of his amazing level of skill. But, you know, you don't really hear too many criminals go, well, I really just couldn't believe how it spoke to me.
What sort of relationship do museum security teams forge with former or perhaps repentant art thieves in order to learn the best ways to keep themselves secure?
Well, they do occasionally deal with the former art thieves. It's a tricky business because it's nothing you'd want to publicize. Just for example, hypothetically, if the Gardner Museum, say, brought in Miles Connor as a consultant. I mean, it would probably be, you know, it would be a kind of a very negative story. People would look askance at that. So to the extent that they do it, they would have to do it with somebody that is, you know, thoroughly reformed and vetted. But they do have a couple of guys. I mean, Bob Whitman, who wrote an excellent book about his career as basically an undercover guy who would go in and pretend to be a buyer and sting the person who had the stolen art. People like that, they really sort of know the underworld of art very well. So, you know, bringing in criminals is not that, in the old sort of it takes a thief vein,
yeah,
it's not that necessary.
Yeah. Is it true, by the way, that Miles Connor's dad was a cop?
Yeah, I mean, Miles, his father was a very respected policeman, and he, you know, Miles had a lot of uncles and friends who were, you know, in law enforcement. So he was, you know, the kind of the bad seed.
Tell us about Al Mundy.
Well, Well, so Al Mundy is a very entertaining character because, you know, he speaks in this very raspy, gruff, sort of mafioso-type voice, you know, and he likes to act as if he knows where everything is, and, you know, he could find the Gardner paintings in 10 minutes. But the thing about Mundy is that, as we write in the book, he actually inaugurated the modern era of art theft at gunpoint. Because before his theft at the Worcester Museum back in 72, really it was break-ins and, you know, sort of pilferage, that sort of thing. And Mundy thought, well, let's just go wave a gun in their face. They'll all, you know, they're all little Barney Fife-type characters. They'll all hit the floor, and, you know, we can take what we want. And you know, and so when he robbed the museum in Worcester, Mass., unfortunately, one of his Confederates, he gave them a gun with one bullet. He didn't really want any bullets in the gun. He figured the gun was enough to scare people. Mm-hmm. Puts one bullet in the gun, and, of course, the guy fires it and shoots a guard in the hip. And so, as Al said, that put blood on the paintings. And after that, it became fairly commonplace to see, you know, what we call the armed blitz.
So without giving up any valuable secrets, can you talk about some of the things that museums have learned to do, some of which may be surprisingly simple, that keep the art safer than it has been?
Well, yeah. In fact, the most basic and simple thing, and I'll tell you a story. Every time I leave the museum with Anthony at the end of the day when he's closing up shop or whatever, he turns to the guard desk and he says, points his finger and he says, "Remember, don't let anyone in." And it's actually really the best advice you can give, because if your perimeter is secure, it's going to be really hard for criminals to get in. But once you let them in the building, or if you're foolish enough as a guard to leave the building and become, like, you know, get kidnapped by them, as happened in Cincinnati, it's all over. So really, he keeps repeating, you know, and it sounds like, oh, my God, how obvious, but you'd be amazed at how, you know, people can be deceived. You know, a guy shows up at the door looking like a firefighter or a plumber or God knows what. So that's number one. And then, yes, the other things they can do is bolt the works to the walls much more securely. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go into a lot of museums, you'd be amazed to see how simple it would be to take a piece of art from the wall with just a Phillips head screwdriver.
Yeah.
And so things like that have been put in place.
And it's funny, it's one of those things where if you look like you know what you're doing and you belong there, maybe because of the culture we've created where security guards are not sort of the highest ranking people in an organization, it's got to be tough.
Exactly. I mean, and the other thing is a lot, you know, bystanders, sometimes you can use the crowd to your advantage. You let a bunch of people crowd around and suddenly, if you have the moxie, as you said before, to step up and look sort of official and start taking him painting down from the wall, they'll think, oh, they must work for the museum. They're obviously moving it to storage. You don't know, and off you go. You can kind of, you know, I mean, you can use a ruse like that, and it can work.
Do people like Amore and like the federal agents who are working on these cases, do they do something as obvious as make sure they keep an eye on what's being sold on eBay?
Oh, yes, good question. Absolutely. Anthony is always checking for several of the objects that were stolen on eBay because similar objects turn up there all the time. For example, one of the things stolen from the Gardner is what's called a finial. It's the little golden statuette that goes at the top of a flagpole. It's shaped like an eagle. It was from a Napoleonic flag. And there's so many of these around. And you know, constantly turning up on eBay. He's constantly getting calls from people saying, "I just saw this in a flea market, and it's yet to be the correct one." But he's always looking. The same with the small Rembrandt self-portrait, which is something people can imitate. So he is looking. In fact, I once actually, I mean, I've searched myself for Storm on the Sea of Galilee on eBay. I actually bought a nice reproduction of one once as a memento. But you're right. You have to do the obvious. Absolutely, you always have to look right under your nose first.
How do museums make sure so many of them are so cavernous that everyone's gone at the end of a open visitor day?
Well, it's a tricky business, and you still get people who can find a way to hide in a museum, particularly if they're, you know, kind of rubber-boned and can fold themselves up pretty small. What they do is just they go room by room by room. They also do have motion sensors. And so, you know, they put the motion sensors on, and you'll get a, you know, if you have a guard in place, you'll get a beep, you know, if somebody starts moving. So that's one way to do it, which is pretty effective. But not all the museums have done that. They don't necessarily have it comprehensively installed. So you can still get that, you know, that sneaky thief scenario.
Do you imagine, I mean, do you fantasize that at some point the people who know where the Gardner Collection Museum, the Gardner Collection items are, will in fact contact you, that you'll be the guy who reunites the museum with its possessions?
Well, you know, I used to have that dream. I really did, because at the time I was first reporting it, I thought, well, I was kind of the neutral party. I wasn't the museum. I wasn't the feds. I wasn't the cops. I was, you know, I was the reporter, so maybe I could be kind of the Switzerland, you know, of the situation. But nowadays, I just doubt that'll happen. I think the people are much more apt to make contact with Amore quietly because, I mean, $5 million is just too much, is a huge amount of money. And, I mean, I'm surprised, frankly, that nobody has turned up any of it, given, you know, I mean, that bounty, it's Osama bin Laden was $25 million, and Whitey Bulger was $2 million. This is actually the biggest reward in the world nowadays.
Hmm. Is it possible that whoever knew where they were hidden has died?
Absolutely. Frankly, that's one. It's a good question. That's actually my ongoing theory. I believe very strongly that there was a little bit of a criminal underworld tug of war for the items after they were stolen, and that the characters who hid them away ended up getting killed, and that the problem became, how do you backtrack and find what might have been their hides or their secret, you know, stash places in order to, you know, ideally find the stuff just sitting there waiting to be recovered.
Did writing the book do anything to lessen your obsession with this case and with the theft of Rembrandts, or has it simply intensified it?
It's intensified, I have to say. I mean, you know, Rembrandt is such an amazing character anyway, and it's heartbreaking to think that his works are lost, because in many ways Rembrandt was a great documentary journalist. He covered, you know, Amsterdam at a time when it was one of the wealthiest cities in the world in great detail. And, you know, you learn all these things looking at Rembrandt, that there were elephants walking down the streets at certain times. You know what everybody look like, sweating over their labors.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there,
sorry,
because we've run out of time. That's all right. Tom Mashberg is co-author of the new book, Stealing Rembrandts, The Untold Stories of Notorious Art Heists. Tom, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.